Welcome to Agency of the Month, brought to you by the CSC and Gen team on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This month's agency is Navy.
Welcome to the program today, focusing on energy at the Navy. My guest is Thomas Hicks, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy. Sir, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you very much. Really looking forward to it.
Let's talk about your experience in the Navy, both this time around and the first time around. You served here before from 1992 to 1996. In what capacity did you serve then? And when you came back in 2010 to take this job, what was different that you saw when you walked in the door?
That's a great question. So when I started back with the Navy back in 92, really it was focused on our shore energy programs. And in fact, one of the things I did at what was then the Public Works Center of Washington was to stand up an energy office that really focused on energy efficiency, doing energy audits across the Navy and the Marine Corps, and really driving toward project and program execution. And it was, I think, very much reflective of the wave that was going through NAVFAC and the Department of Navy at the time. I think what's different then and now in this role that I have is how comprehensive the energy program is. So certainly the shore energy focus has continued, and I think we've got an excellent track record in our programs, and it's testament to that. Over the last 10 years, 30% of all of the energy awards from the Federal Energy Management Program government-wide have come to the Navy. And I think that really speaks to the incredible efforts of the Navy and Marine Corps. Today, though, we're focused obviously still on those activities on our shore, but really taking that same kind of ethos and culture throughout our operational side, which is where 75% of our energy use is to power our fleet, the aircraft and ships that we have.
Now, a lot of focus when people look from the outside at the military on energy is focused on alternative fuels, and certainly we'll talk about alternative fuels through the course of the program. Is it fair to say, though, that you're also focused on the traditional forms of energy and reducing, finding efficiencies and so on?
Absolutely. So whether it's the best kilowatt hour or the best barrel of oils or the ones we don't use. And so what you see us doing is focusing a lot of our effort on being more efficient. And certainly we'll come to that, whether it's for the shore, whether it's for our fleet in different ways. But being more efficient is job one. That said, we also need to look at what the other possibilities are. So for our shore activities, we have to look at renewable energy. And I think we've got a great program there that's really focused on large-scale renewables. As we look at our operational activities, we've got to look at alternative energy. The fleet we have today, the ships and aircraft we have today, 3,700 aircraft, roughly 285 ships, roughly, are the ones we're going to have for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So that the ships we have today and the aircraft we have today, the ones we're going to have in the future. So really looking at alternative sources of fuel where we can, and looking to how we can make those ships and aircraft more efficient as we go forward.
Now, you use the terms renewable energy and alternative energy as two different terms. So there's a distinction there, I imagine. Tell me about that, because I have a tendency, and others probably have a tendency, to interchange them.
Yeah, so renewable energy is going to be looking at technologies such as wind and solar, geothermal, waste energy, and things like that, really kind of focused on kind of more of a shore-focused definition. Alternative energy includes that. Alternative energy also includes nuclear, so as we look at our fleet, includes nuclear power. It includes biofuels, advanced biofuels, and others. So it's really alternative energy kind of encompasses renewables, but also brings in a couple of other technologies as well.
When you analyze the various forms of alternatives and renewables, is cost the only factor? Is the method in which they're being used, the ultimate mission that they're serving, part of the equation? What all is considered there?
Well, certainly cost is always going to be really important, and certainly as we are in the fiscal environment that we're in, cost is going to be at the top of the list. However, more important to that, and what we're getting from our operational efforts, is additional combat capability. We're able to have ships that are on task for a longer duration that don't have to go through underway replenishments as often, and that means that they're ready and available for tasking. On our shore side, it means that we are using less energy, that we are a better partner with our outside utility companies, and that really enhances the overall grid security that we find ourselves in. So in both cases, it's not, energy cost is certainly a driver, but there are other benefits that really go right to our combat capability and reducing the vulnerabilities that we have, whether it's the grid for our shore or whether it's fuel for our ships and aircraft.
Let's start ashore and talk about the efforts that you're making or at installations in the United States and around the world. Talk about some of the developments that you are working on there.
Absolutely. So we have one of the goals that Secretary Mabus laid out for the Navy in October 2009 is that half of our energy from our shore activities and across the entire Navy, in fact, will come from alternative sources. To that end, more recently, as the President announced in the State of the Union address, complementing that notion is that we'll pursue 1 gigawatt of renewable energy produced or procured by our installations. And so to that end, we have three terrific examples at Barstow, 29 Palms, and China Lake, where together we'll have three power purchase agreements that will produce 16, 17 megawatts of power through photovoltaic arrays. And from day one of those 20-year contracts, they will provide power cheaper than what we would get from those conventional sources. Mm-hmm. And over the life of those projects, they will save, they will escalate at a rate lower than what the utilities will likely be. So we'll save, it's estimated we'll save about $20 million over the life of those 20-year contracts. Those are some of the examples that we're taking forward. We have another tremendous one in China Lake where we have have operated for more than 25 years a geothermal plant that's providing power to the grid that we're able to take advantage of, and also providing some sources of revenue back to the Navy that we use to advance other energy exploration.
And if I recall about the 29 Palms example, there's an incentive to the contractor that's doing the job, too, so it's a win-win on both sides. Is that right?
I believe so. With the contractor, they're certainly incentivized to make sure that the plant itself, the PV plant, operates as intended. They obviously have financiers that they're beholden to, and they need to make sure that plant is run as efficiently as it can be. And so this isn't something where the Navy is taking ownership of the panels and having to maintain those. Really, we're relying on the contractor to do that and to meet those objectives.
Let's go on to the seas now and talk about some of the things that you're doing there, various forms of replacement fuels, and I'm familiar with the term drop-in fuels. Talk about how the Navy is approaching that and what you're requiring from the vendors that you're buying fuels from, what you're doing to try to accentuate the process of closing the differential between cost per gallon of alternatives and traditional fossil fuels.
Sure. And maybe let me start by saying, why we're after this. And again, it's about increasing our combat capabilities, mission effectiveness, but the point to emphasize here is about reducing that vulnerability. And the specific vulnerability here is around the volatility, if you will, of fuel prices. And so for us, for every dollar increase in the price per barrel of fuel, that's a $30 million bill to the Navy. This year, in FY12, the year of execution, the Navy received, as did all the services, an increase of $38 per barrel. So for us, that was over $1 billion of additional cost. Alternative fuels, drop-in advanced biofuels, provide the hope and promise that we can mitigate that. It's not the answer, but we think it's part of an answer that we can come up with to do that. So for us, the alternative fuels that we are pursuing, as you mentioned, are drop-in. They also have to have characteristics. They have to have life cycle greenhouse gas emissions equal to or less than petroleum. That's required by law, the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, Section 526. We also want to make sure that the fuels that we use do not compete with food and food stocks. We're interested in related issues such as water use and land use as well. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that the choices that we make, obviously they have to be go through our testing and certification program, have to be transparent to the operator. But nonetheless, those choices that we make don't have any negative and second-order and third-order impacts. We're trying to avoid that. So as it relates to we have tested all of our manned and unmanned aircraft. We're going through and testing our surface combatants as well, and we'll have completed that by the end of this year. And then notably in July of this year at the Rim of the Pacific event, we're actually going to have a carrier strike group, four ships and an air wing, on alternative fuels, 50-50 blends of alternative fuels. And so that's kind of the waypoint for not only the Navy and the services, but commercial industry as well, is the 50-50 blends. So 50% conventional, 50% alternative is what we're looking for. In terms of feedstocks, it can be really a whole variety of things and processes. So it can be anything from mustard seeds or variants of mustard seeds like camelina, which we've used. It could be waste oils, such as we just purchased through Dynamic Fuels for our Great Green Fleet 2012 effort, which is truly a partnership between them and Tyson's Foods. It can be algae-based. It can be municipal solid waste. There's really quite a variety. And in the future, there's other ones that we'll look at, such as pyrolysis oils and alcohols to jets and a variety of other ones that we'll look at that we think have a lot of promise.
When you say municipal solid waste, is that what I think it is?
It is, and actually there's two forms. There's the waste that goes to the water treatment plants, and so there's a sludge that's created. That's, as we understand it, kind of a difficult thing to have to deal with. That sludge has essentially energy content in it, and you can turn that into some alternative fuels. Similarly, municipal solid waste, if you think about it, you know, what we do today traditionally in the United States is we take that and we put it in a landfill and bury it. Well, that the things that we put into that landfill, that stuff, is it contains embodied energy. And typically over time, that embodied energy will release in the form of methane. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you design new landfills today, most of those will come with ways to capture and use that methane. But there's also ways to kind of screen out some of the materials that have high energy content that you can use to create fuels.
You're listening to Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Thomas Hicks. He's Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy. And our conversation will continue in a moment.
CSE stands ready to partner with the Department of Navy on Next Generation Enterprise Network to achieve a fully integrated naval networking environment. The world-class CSC team, including Harris, General Dynamics IT, and Verizon, has the experience to deliver innovative networking solutions that enhance performance, improve security, and cut costs to affordably meet evolving needs of sailors and Marines today and for years to come. Visit NGenReady.com for more information. That's NGenReady.com.
Thanks for listening to Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For the month of March, it's the United States Navy. And my guest is Thomas Hicks, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy. Mr. Secretary, in the first segment, you mentioned a couple of things I'd like to follow up on. You talked about, almost offhandedly, about the prospect of increasing combat capability through using alternatives and renewables. The message I hear from that is, We get this. This is kind of secondhand. This is second nature when it comes to that. But that might not be the piece that most people expect. By using these methods of energy, we'll actually be more capable in combat. Expand on that a little bit, if you would, please.
Absolutely. So let me give you maybe two examples. One would be with the Marine Corps with their experimental forward operating base, which they did back in March of 2010. And what they did, they invited industry in to come into a mock forward operating base environment and said, all right, bring us your technologies, your energy and renewable energy technologies that we might be able to take into theater. And then after playing with those technologies, understanding how those technologies work, using them in some testing and training, they were able to take those technologies into theater. In fact, the worst part of the fight in the Sangin province, Company 3-5 took several technologies. They were LED lights for their tents. They were shelter liners for their tents. They were solar blankets that allowed to charge their batteries. And what they found was pretty amazing. They saved 25 to 90% of the energy use in theater, taking out the need for the fuel convoys. So for one in every 50 fuel convoys, we have one Marine that's killed or wounded. And so the more fuel and water they can take out of theater, that impacts that dramatically. So more sailors and Marines can go home to their families. I think in terms of the capabilities, what it also did is it reduced how many batteries they had to go out on patrol with. And so in the case of patrols that would go out for that would require a battery refresh every 2, 3, 4 days, they were able now to go out with these solar blankets and able to go out 3 weeks without a resupply. Mm-hmm. So that's 3 weeks without not having to have somebody come in resupply them into some dangerous parts of the country. That whole idea, those technologies, because of their overwhelming demand in theater, actually are now, over the past year, going out to all the brigades in Afghanistan. And I think it's the payback in terms of financial is about a 6-month, year payback. back. Mm-hmm. But the returns in terms of bringing sailors and Marines back home to their families is even better. And certainly the additional capabilities that we get from that is really impactful too. The other example I would cite is just as it relates to some of the efficiency efforts we have with the fleet. So as I mentioned before, we have 285 ships, many of which are going to be with us for decades to come. So what we can do there is to make them incrementally more efficient. Technologies such as stern flaps, as hull coatings, and propeller coatings, which make the ships go through the water better, make them more efficient. And what it also does is it gives them more range. More range equals more combat capability. It also equals being able to be on station longer, be ready for taskings longer, so that we can, if required, that they can be, wherever they're called, whether it's to protect the global commons, to fight piracy efforts or humanitarian assistance or whatever or other combat needs, whatever were needed, they can be there and can be there without having to go out and refuel and be offline for periods of time. So in both cases, it's about providing that additional capability that we can use.
When we talked about some of the sources of alternative fuels, you mentioned that one thing that was important, one consideration, is that these sources not compete with food, with the food chain. Is this a lesson learned from at least the perceived shortage of corn a couple of years back when corn was kind of the preeminent source of alternative fuel?
Yeah, I think it is, but it's also recognizing what the opportunities are today and that we can use feedstocks that are grown in rotation with food crops. So, again, not competing with the food crops. And also we can use different types of feedstocks that don't use feedstocks or don't directly compete as well, whether it's like an algae or, as I mentioned before, municipal solid waste or the waste from wastewater treatment plants. There's so many different types of fuels, waste oils. There's just more of a recognition that there's a wider variety than the fuels that we use today, ethanol, which we can't really use to power our fleet for a number of reasons, but there's many other sources of fuel. But certainly that was a consideration in that choice to not use food as a feedstock.
When you talk about things like the coatings and paints on pieces in the inventory and things like that, how much of this is concerted research and development projects, and how much of it is just people at all levels of the force just stepping back and thinking about this stuff for a little while?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly as we go forward and put those technologies, which, yeah, if you just step back and think about it, yeah, these just make sense. They're almost intuitive. That many of those types of technologies, though, need to be proven out. We need to get to, the ground truth, if you will, a lot of those technologies to make sure that they can prove out. So when we go out and test more recently, we have a hybrid electric drive that we have on the USS Macon Island, which allows that ship to go under electric power for good part of its portfolio or performance envelope. We can take those same types of ideas and test them out in existing destroyers and retrofit applications, and that's part of what we're doing now. So we need to understand and take some of those same ideas, and some of these ideas have been in the commercial sector and used in other ways, and we are adapting that. That said, I think we also need to look to continue to innovate. I think the Department of Defense and certainly the Department of Navy have histories in this area where we have been at that forefront of innovation, and those innovations certainly have delivered benefits to the Navy and Department of Defense, but also have had spillover impacts into the commercial sector. Mm-hmm.
You talk about retrofit applications and some of the turnarounds where you get payback on an investment in a particularly tight budget time like we're in now. Do you run up against some difficulty in making those initial investments when the payback might be longer than a year or two? A year or two, I would imagine, is pretty easy to convince Congress this is worth investing money in.
Yeah, I think for us, again, certainly as it relates to our operational side of the house, again, that's where we have 75% of our energy. Being able to, certainly we need to be able to talk in economic terms, but really why we're pursuing this is about enhancing our combat capabilities. And so that's the discussion we have to say, this is what this efficiency gain gets us. Certainly as we do the calculus on the economics, that has to pencil out as well. And we have to show that when and where these technologies make sense. I think the relationship with the Hill has been very productive, and we're able to have those, I think, very earnest discussions about, what combat capabilities do we get, balancing that with what energy and efficiencies that we get from that as well. And as you stated, especially in these times, I think we need to do that so that we can provide the most efficient, most capable, most lethal fighting force that we can within the budget constraints that we have.
I want to talk about the culture of this for a minute, if we could, because a number of ex and current military leaders from all the branches have said, for a long time until just a short time ago, if we needed to get in a tank, we got in a tank and did it, or we needed to get in an airplane or do whatever we needed to do, we just did it. We didn't really think about the energy footprint at all. What's the culture shift been like, especially considering your time here before until coming back a couple of years ago, about that thought process? This is something we have to do differently, and it's something that we kind of have to embed in the thought process in the culture.
Yeah, I think what's been different is a number of things, but I will say it also builds upon some really great efforts that we already had. So my efforts prior to coming, or my first time around with the Navy, was really focused on our shore activities. And again, there they already had a great program focused on energy and have continued to build that since. And so it's been a great effort. I think what's been different is really more that focus on our operational side. And so with respect to the culture piece, I think it's safe to say that energy is making its way in all efforts, on all echelons within the Navy and the Marine Corps. And I'll just give you a few examples. And so we have at the Naval Postgraduate School, we have a master's program. So the Naval Postgraduate School is where the future leaders of the Navy and Marine Corps will often come from. There's now an energy program, energy master's program, that's been started as of last fall, and we'll begin to get folks through there. There'll be an analog course focused on flag officers and executives, senior executives as well, to get energy into that. The Marine Corps, for example, has put energy into their doctrine, and so now energy is going to be part of every Marine's career going forward. And just really highlighting the importance and highlighting energy as a capability, not as something that's always going to be there, like air. Mm-hmm. We know that that's not necessarily the case, and we have to be very mindful of how we use energy and what that might how that might impact us in terms of our future engagements. I would also say look at our acquisitions. We have energy that's now part of every major acquisition going forward, and that's starting to play out. We have a ship-to-shore energy program that is all about culture change, and so when ships pull up to shore, they're really mindful and thoughtful about what they need to leave on, that to make sure that ship's ready to go at a moment's notice, and what they can reasonably turn off or turn down. And I think those practices not only impact the individual ship that might be at that pier, but also all the ships of that same type, the same ship type, and really providing that same kind of process out. And so the Fleet Forces Command has, as of last November, is really now asking and requiring all the ship type commanders to follow those same types of procedures. We have many other programs focused on our homes. We've got a pilot going out where we're testing, providing some building information to the residents of some public-private housing that we have, and with great effect, and a number of other efforts that we have underway, really getting into this culture change, because that's really, I think that's where the power of this will come from, and where we can get a lot of results is from the really instilling this ethos, this energy ethos within the Navy and the Marine Corps.
Mr. Secretary, I'm grateful for your time today. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you very much. It's been a privilege.
Thomas Hicks is Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy. The Navy's our focus on Agency of the Month, and you can hear all of our programs archived at federalnewsradio.com. Search term Agency of the Month. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Agency of the Month, brought to you by the CSC NGEN team on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Search Navy. Agency of the Month, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m., only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Your source for federal news now.